Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel. And today we have a special guest in Mr. Alexei Chernobylsky from Centrio Capital Partners. Before we dive in, I want to cut a deal with you. If you get more than $500 worth of value out of this show, would you mind please heading over and leaving a review of this podcast wherever you tune in from? This should only take around 30 seconds, and it keeps me motivated to keep recording these. Before we dive in, I want to make sure everybody knows Alexei is not endorsing me. I'm not endorsing him. This is just a conversation, hopefully to add as much value as possible to limited partner investors out there. All right, let's dive in. Alexei is a limited partner advisor. He currently writes to over 3,500 LP investors every week via his Substack and has a huge presence on Twitter and LinkedIn with over 20,000 followers. He previously managed a $10 billion, billion with a B, real estate portfolio at Store Capital, which was a public REIT encompassing over 3,000 properties. And while at Store, he led the firm's 20-member underwriting team. Alexei holds a quadruple major from the University of Arizona in finance, mathematics, economics, and accounting. Alexei, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Would you mind starting out by just telling us a little about your story and how you transitioned from, you know, corporate real estate and that whole world to now advising limited partners?
For sure. I think the best way to tell the story is just realizing the fact that it was pretty random. You know, I left and I had a decent amount of plans. That was like in early 2022. Rates changed, as I'm sure you're aware. And that, you know, kind of made me question whether my plans were good. And at some point I decided to put those to the side. And then I slowly got introduced to the syndication space. I had a few different experiences advising syndicators in different matters. And I guess that whole world all of a sudden opened up to me. Like, I meaning when I was living and breathing the public REIT universe, I didn't even know what syndications were, to be candid. Like, I didn't know that they existed. And then slowly but surely, I realized how large this space is in terms of dollars that are deployed across all the different asset classes. And what I found to be particularly interesting is kind of like the opaqueness. I don't know if that's an English word. One of my B's in college was English. So I didn't really understand how opaque this marketplace is, you know, in terms of like the LPs and GPs. Many LPs don't really understand like what's market in terms of terms. Many of them have no idea like how to even vet an investment. Some of them still call me to this day and they're like, real estate is safe. Like the worst thing that can happen is I just get my money back because you can sell the asset. And the same person, you know, a few seconds before said they want to invest $1 million. So like it just like sort of opened my eyes to this really big marketplace that I think needs to be served a little bit better. And I decided to try and do it. And so, you know, here I am.
That's fantastic. Would you mind going back and telling us, you know, what was it like, you know, working and leading an underwriting team at a publicly traded REIT, you know, Store Capital? And then also, you know, you were there during the pandemic, correct?
Yeah.
So that had to be a crazy time. But yeah, you know, what does a typical week look like? You know, you were managing the underwriting team. How many deals were you looking at? And then maybe talk about the pandemic, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so there's only so much I can speak about, obviously. But I think what I can say is the weeks are pretty wild. You know, in terms of the experience that it brought for me, and also I think as it relates to LPs, I think this is very relevant. You know, in any given week, we would look at, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and in some cases, like upwards of 20 or 30 deals. And those are deals that actually got submitted to my team. Whereas there's, you know, probably 5x more that just got passed beforehand. And so that sort of went into the underwriting funnel, you can call it. And then I had a team of 20, as you said, that were specializing in specific industries. And their job would be to sort of like understand the information on the given property, the alignment of incentives between the different people, the risk levels, how the business is performing, et cetera, et cetera. And then ultimately make a recommendation. And then I obviously was very involved with the team. I was in, a part of investment committee in terms of deciding ultimately whether the risk reward on a given deal was worthwhile, or we need to restructure it, or we just pass. And I think there's maybe two lessons there for LPs that I think are worthwhile to note. I still speak to LPs every day that, they kind of tend to think that like they got a deal in front of them and it's like they need to like make a decision now. And if they miss it, they might not get another deal from the GP or might not have another opportunity. Like I just don't think that's a good way of thinking about investments. Typically, I guide people to like at least looking at 10 deals or at least five, let's say, for every one that you actually invest in. Of course, like that really depends on where those deals come from, right? Perhaps the first one you got was a really good one, right? But generally speaking, it's just this mindset that people need to understand that investing takes time, it's complex, takes a lot of education. I think people that ignore that, I don't know if there's a better way of putting it, but I think it's basically, it kind of at some point it becomes glorified gambling. It can become pretty dangerous, I think, because you feel like you're investing, but you're gambling. And the problem is with gambling, you know enough to sort of like, you're gambling, right? So you sort of like limit the amount of money that you go to the casino with. With investing, it's like, you put half of your savings up, thinking you're going to like retire from your 9-to-5 or whatever. And then you realize it's, some of those work out, some of them don't. And it's just, it's tough,
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think, right, like the last 7 years, right, like we're pretty good, right? The next seven, are not guaranteed to be like that. So, some people that made money on a deal, I think I heard you say this in another podcast. It's like, hey, just because you made money, or maybe this is in one of your posts, just because you made money on a deal with an operator doesn't mean that, you need to, reinvest with them, right? Like you need to really analyze the deal and the specifics and the structure and everything, just like it's a brand new investment. So I thought that was, really, really accurate. What would you say, like, how can an LP best vet a general partner, syndicator before investing with them? Like, do you have any tips for people on kind of how to do that? I think that's one thing, when I've interviewed other people, they've said, hey, the general partner and their track record are most important, right? Like the jockey or the horse, right? You want to bet on the jockey. Sure. So, how could they vet a general partner?
So I guess, first of all, I can give many counterexamples, and I'm not going to do it in public, where betting on the jockey that was not a good idea, right? So in other words, I think people need to be cognizant of the fact that track record is important, but also, I don't know how else to say this, but the GP game, ethics aside, which I don't want to put aside, but sometimes you need to make points. Ethics aside, it's a fee-based business. And there are many examples of GPs sort of getting above their skis on investments that I think they even in private would admit were not really sound. Now, in terms of your actual question, and I perhaps the segue is really well into this. I really don't like to think about like a specific thing that you should focus on. Because this is just my experience and this is what happens, right? Like Andrew, I'll sometimes people ask me like, what's the number one thing that is a red flag, right? So like I have an article called Top 15 Syndication Mistakes. Like I think there's two paragraphs in there that literally talk about this idea that these are not red flags. There's reasons to stop and think. In other words, one of the things that I wrote in there is generally, if you see a split that is less favorable than 65% to LP, you should stop and think. Not that you should pass. You should just understand why this deal is different, right? And I think what people want to do is just be like, oh, I found one that's 50-50 or whatever. Like, therefore, I pass. And then just like that, again, that goes back to like gambling as opposed to investing. Because what you missed in the 50-50 is the fact that on the next page, it said that there was a 50-50 co-invest. Like, and that's not normal. And maybe on the following page, it said that there's a 10% pref, and that's better than market too. But you just passed on a deal just because you saw something and it was like sort of off market, let's say. And this is what I do for clients too. Like whenever someone hires me, I have like three pillars that I go through in my analysis. The first pillar, and they're very much in order, Andrew. So I think we're in agreement that vetting the GP comes first. I think what I call that is execution, right? So under execution comes, do they have a background in this? Do they have experience running a similar business plan on properties like this? Are they trustworthy? Like, you know, Google searches, legal background, like all that stuff sort of comes first. Second is alignment of interests, which is a combination of fees, co-invest, and then also the waterfall structure. And then the third is the actual property, which I think, to your earlier point, like it surprises people when they see that third. But I think people forget that these are silent investments. Like you're really need to trust someone, which is A. B is, if things don't work out, are they incentivized monetarily to do all the right things? That's alignment of interest. And C is like, once you sort of pass A and B, how's the property? Which is obviously important. I'm not belittling it, but the idea is that, in my opinion, at least comes third. Look, in terms of vetting the GP, there are no secrets. I'm saying like, and I think this is also a complicated topic because people will just bash on GPs that are doing their first deal. And it's like every single successful GP at some point had to do their first deal. Mm. On the other hand, I see people bashing on GPs that maybe started with family capital before doing their first syndication. It's like, does it really matter where the cash came from? Like, okay, sure. Like they had some help. But like what matters is the numbers, right? Like, I don't know, person A might have taken 6 weeks to raise the money. Person B got it overnight. Okay. I mean, the deal is the deal, you know? And I think what's really important is making sure that everything is represented in an honest way. And that, Andrew, is like, it's pretty complicated to get that right as a retail LP. I just don't know how else to say that because there's a lot that's missing on decks typically. And it's not really available on Google. Like, meaning, just to give you an example, you might be able to find a lawsuit and perhaps the lawsuit is legitimate and it's like related to the GP's, like, let's say, honesty or whatever. So like, okay, that's relevant. But does an incoming LP know that the GP is like a few weeks away from foreclosing on half of their portfolio? The answer is no. And in fact, like, you look at their deck and they're like, their deck shows like, look at all these properties we own and it's X hundred million AUM or whatever. And there's like, I mean, to be candid, there's just no way for them to figure that out. Right. Which is kind of that goes back to my whole thesis of like how opaque this marketplace is. And, you know, I certainly hope to address it, you know, one day at a time.
I love that. No, that's really interesting, right? Like a GP could be raising money right now for a new deal and present a portfolio, but they could literally be close to going bankrupt on their portfolio, like, and not have to disclose that.
Yeah. And if you want, we can take it further. Like, do they have to disclose it? I'm serious. Like, I think this is an interesting, it's a very interesting ethical debate, which doesn't really have boundaries. In other words,
it's kind of like a Ponzi scheme, right? Like they're raising for one while they're losing on another. I mean, it seems
so. Look, it's certainly to me, it's very clear that it's very gray, right? But the reality of some of these situations is you're not foreclosed on until you're foreclosed on, right? Now, here's an extreme example. Like, what if you make a statement that says our entire portfolio is healthy and we then like here are the expected IRRs per property while knowing that, like, let's say half of them are, you know, in severe distress. So that to me is like sort of very clearly dishonest, right? But what I'm talking about is more like gray. Like, let's say you don't talk about the performance of the properties and you're just like, here's a map of everything that we own and we're so big, so diversified, and you just don't mention anything. So is that unethical? It's complicated, Andrew. Like, and again, there's no rules about this.
And that's why you're saying it's very opaque, which is, it makes it scary, right? And like, there's additional risk associated with this. And I heard on another podcast, you said, hey, you know, right now, a lot of syndicators, general partners, are really fighting against people wanting to leave their money in a CD or a money market where they can earn 5.25%. And, you know, in order to lure someone to take the risk of investing into a real estate deal, you know, where do those returns likely need to be, Alexei, you know, from your perspective?
Look, I'm going to avoid sort of like tax benefits because I think many times they don't apply to everyone. Obviously, if they do, that helps. But I also don't think that should sort of make investment decisions for you.
Yeah,
that's right. In terms of where I guide people, I mean, I think it's 10% at least, right? Like if you can have liquidity and like quite literally, I mean, you know, I guess we can have a debate on whether the government is still risk-free or not. But like if you can get 5% money, then of course there's questions on how long that lasts. You know, that's a whole other debate. But, you know, I think if you show a deal that's like 7 or 8, people probably aren't excited, right? Because they can get those levels of returns elsewhere in a more diversified manner. So I think it's like 10 plus. The problem though, Andrew, is I think people sometimes overemphasize IRRs to their own detriment, to be honest. Like they'll cut deals out that are, let's say, 11% IRR because, man, I don't have time to like focus on this 11% IRR deal. I have 5 others in my inbox that are 20 plus. And then, then actually what ends up happening, not always, but I've certainly seen it, is they sort of self-select the more aggressive GPs with aggressive underwriting assumptions and select out the GPs that try to be more conservative, which is probably, like, just all else equal, probably not what you wanted in the first place. You know, so it's just something to look out for.
That's good. Let's talk about downside risk. You know, I listened to a previous podcast and you're big on that being an initial filter when reviewing a deal. And instead of, you know, I think all of us have a tendency to immediately look at the upside. You know, would you mind maybe, you know, shedding some light on that, on like, you know, hey, you know, how, what is a good way to kind of, you know, run through that filter?
Yeah. So I guess for anyone that wants to see the table that I'm going to refer to, you can Google "Don't Lose Money" with my name, or "Don't Lose Money LP Lessons." I'm sure it'll come up. I think the reason why this is important is, I mean, A, first of all, Andrew, I think there's sort of like this very unhealthy misconception in real estate investments that the worst thing that can happen is you getting your money back. And I think that is, somewhere between delusional just like not informed, all the way to pretty dangerous. The reason why this matters is, and I have like a data table on this for the folks that are interested, but like if you take a 50% loss on an investment, so you know, let's say you invested 500 grand, 5 years later you made 250 back, right? And that's it. But like the investment just didn't go as planned, you got 250 back, then you invested that into something else, and risk-free, which is an assumption, you're going to make 8% per year, right? Meaning you found the risk-free investment, so to speak, that guarantees you 8% a year. It will take you 9 years at that point to get back to your 500 grand. And again, I think this is one of those things. Unfortunately, I talk to people that are going through this, right? And this assumes that you get 50% of your money back. In some cases, you get nothing. And so I think people acknowledging the fact that downside is real and it can happen is the first step. In terms of actually analyzing it and understanding what could happen, I think it's a function of understanding the catalysts or the assumptions in the investment that can have the highest impact in terms of the investment thesis, right? Many times, and I've spoken about this publicly, many times that's the exit cap rate. That's sort of like, that tends to be like certainly a hot spot. And I also say very publicly that you know, there's nothing wrong with assuming anything. Like the GP can assume whatever they want, and you as an LP can sign up for whatever you want. It's the free, it's America, right? But my only request is always like, if you're signing up for something, you should understand what it is before you wire the check, right? So just to give you an example, let's say you're buying something at like a Performa 7, and then you're going to stabilize it, and then you're saying, I'm going to sell this at a 4. So again, no hard feelings. Like I could care less what the assumption is, but it is super important for the LP to understand that that assumption is being made. And I don't know if you can relate, but I can tell you 9 out of 10 decks that I look at don't make that clear. It's sort of like something you have to like reverse engineer into, even if you can't in some circumstances. But and at that point, you just have to understand that this is a macro bet, right? And if it's a macro bet, you know, perhaps it has something to do with like the local geography that you really believe in as the LP, and you're sort of like making a play on that, plus a bit of a play on interest rates. But you have to understand that that's not a bet in the property. It's like, and it's not a bet in the GP. Like the GP cannot control where cap rates go. Your property can't control where cap rates go to a very large extent. I mean, there's like some exceptions to that, but not many. It's really important to understand what you're getting
unknowable.
Behind.
Yeah, it's unknowable. Yeah. And yeah, I think that exit cap rate assumption is an easy way to, you know, make an 11% IRR look like, you know, 15 to 20%, you know, very easily. Yeah. So yeah.
And that's why, you know, like, again, focusing, you just using the exact example you gave, like you threw out one deal that has a 20%, that has 10% IRR. You kept another deal that has 20% IRR, but like they're identical, and the only difference is an exit cap rate assumption. And you're going into an investment not realizing this is a macro level, like a gamble, basically. Yeah. And again, I never tell LPs what to do. So I sort of see my role as making sure they understand what they're getting into. And the thing is, you just have to understand that this is beyond the control of the GP.
Yeah, it should be more straightforward. And you gave a good example of this. You were reviewing a investment update, and you said it was like a quarterly update, and there was 35 or you know something pages, and it, you know, the first 34 pages looked beautiful. There was a new dog park installed. You know, they're doing all these improvements, and then you got to the 35th page, and what did it say?
Something along the lines of like, we predict that there's a very high chance of like losing capital and a decent chance of losing all capital, which, I mean, I kind of said that tongue in cheek, but the reality is like, I think that happens more than you and I have seen it, Andrew, and it sucks.
That's a benefit that you're bringing, right? Yeah. Like you're trying to dig through the kind of every slide deck looks good, right? But it's like, hey, does the deal actually look good, you know, and fishing that out, and are the assumptions reasonable? So,
and for what it's worth, I think, I don't know. And I don't necessarily have like data that I've like gathered to say this, but I think from the reporting packages that I've seen in general, I think 60 or 70% of them are like this, meaning this has the extreme ending, right? That's like super extreme, but let's tone it down and say like, forget the loss of capital. What if that wasn't in there? Is that any better? Like, in other words, like, what if I just told you about dog parks and leasing updates and, you know, like the new paint, but I forgot to mention that like next month our rate cap expires and I have no idea what's going to happen. Right. Is that better? I would say that's probably worse. Other words, at least page 35 told me that there's an issue and I'm probably going to lose capital. It set some expectations. Unless it's not clear, in case it's not clear, I certainly think that's more important than the dog park update, and it should be kind of like not on page 35. But there's like varying degrees of this sort of, you know, just ignoring the most important updates and sort of like
burying,
pushing
bad
forward
news.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think almost every time that is not good.
Yeah. One thing I want to make sure we touch on, you mentioned this, is, you know, always look at, hey, how's the deal capitalized? you know, most LPs, you said, really don't understand this part of the deal and how it can add risk. Would you mind maybe, you know, touching on that a little bit, like how deals are being put together, the capital stack and so forth? Because like you said, you know, if you're just looking at the IRR, you know, expectation or projections, you know, you may not see that, hey, this guy's being more conservative. He's getting a fixed rate for 7 years, or this guy over here, you know, has this bridge debt and has all this additional risk that, you know, is underlying.
So I guess first I'd point to two different articles that are like very much addressing this topic. One is called "Is My Investment Distressed?" which was essentially like it's meant to be a guide for LPs that are, you know, I guess you can say lost, you know, in terms of, hey, is my investment doing okay or not, right? And you sort of have a situation where the GP is not so honest or straightforward, let's say, about what's going on. And you have some information and you can kind of like try to figure out what's happening. That's number one. And then another one that's relevant is 5 ways in which real estate can lose you money. That's another relevant one.
And I'll put these in the show notes, you know, so we make sure that we can touch on those. But I know you have a ton of articles, a ton of good content.
Yeah. And so like, I think the reason why I'm mentioning it is that those two articles address two slightly different things. But as you pointed out, Andrew, like the overarching theme of both is distress doesn't happen in a vacuum. Distress typically happens because there's a capital partner that needs to be paid. That can be an equity partner, it can be a pref equity partner, it can be a lender, it can be the seller in some cases, if there's like a carryback or something, meaning there has to be something that necessitates action, right? A sale, a refi, whatever it is, right? And so because of that, you can't ignore the capital structure because your investment is predicated based on returns. And those returns are based on you being able to pay off that partner in time. And so as you alluded to, a portion of this is understanding the risk in terms of interest rates, right? Like, for example, is this a fixed instrument or variable? I think another aspect of it is the priority of payments, right? Just for an LP to understand that, you know, I get this question a lot, which is like, you know, worst thing that happens is we just sell the property and we make our money back. But then obviously that has a big assumption on it. And that assumption is ignoring fees and closing costs and whatever. The assumption is that the property is worth the same exact amount that you paid for it when you want to sell it. But just understanding like the basic mechanics of the fact that equity can go down, it can fluctuate. In some cases, there could not be any equity and you could be in negative equity. I mean, I've seen cases where the property is worth, in some cases, like 30 to 40% of the lender, like lender's principal in the deal.
Wow. So that's principal. So that's not even...
Yeah, like you can forget about equity, right? Like you're like the lender
down payment down, like all that's wiped out and then some.
Yeah, I think the down payment was like 20% or something like that. It was like pretty highly levered, but all of that is gone and like the lender's investment is like extremely impaired as well, which was even for those things that I see pretty extreme. but it happens.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, what stories do you have of some, you know, kind of sticky situations, you know, that have kind of come across your desk?
How much time do you have? Look, I think the underlying themes of what's going on right now is people are realizing that in distress situations, LP interest and GP interest tend to diverge. And that is why it's so important to understand those things up front, right? So one specific example of that is if there's distress in a property and you can get out, let's say, but get 50% back of your original equity, an LP will sort of beg the GP, just sell, like, please just give me something. I don't want to like be in this deal anymore. And the GP can, I mean, you can sort of like, I'm putting ethics aside, obviously they're super important, but just from an economics and like business perspective, the GP's incentive many times is actually to kick the can down the road, because you don't want to record on your track record, or even worse, like sort of speak publicly on the news or whatever. You know, you don't want to be publicly known as the GP that lost investor capital. So on the one hand, you want to like make LPs happy, but on the other hand, you've got a business to run. The business depends on raising more money, and you sort of have this bad apple, right? And then so like you start seeing divergence of interests in those circumstances that, you know, it creates some pretty challenging times.
Some weird situations, yeah. And I think it's interesting that, you know, obviously interest rates, you know, went up significantly and pretty fast. So there's a lot of these weird situations, you know, happening right now that, you know, 10 years ago, we weren't talking about. Even 5 years ago, we weren't talking about. Yeah. So I guess, what else don't we know, Alexi, that you think would add value to our LP listeners out there? Like what else do you think we should, you know, make sure they know to educate them? I think we've been kind of pessimistic a little bit about, you know, LP investing and syndications. You know, I guess, yeah, how could we leave them off with some additional value?
I think a proper investor mindset is one that is reasonably optimistic, right? Meaning, as you said earlier, Andrew, like you need to look at the upside. Otherwise, like, why are you investing? Just put it in the stock market index, whatever, or treasuries, right? You need to be able to see the vision, to see the upside in this deal. At the same time, you also have to protect your downside, right? And so I think in my articles is like a healthy dose of skepticism. I think it's actually extremely important. And I think it has to be a healthy amount, right? Meaning you can't just like look at every deal and try to kill it. At some point, you're just going to have your cash under a pillow. Like you need to be able to take risk. You're not going to be able to get all your answers in any deal. I mean, I can tell you, I always had more questions before we put dollars out at store. And I think the same thing with LPs. And, you know, in terms of the upside, I speak pretty publicly about the benefits. I mean, beyond the return, I think it's pretty cool to be able to like participate in a specific asset, see it flourishing. Obviously, you get the tax benefits that everyone talks about. I think this is another thing that is often missed is I think you can just find this to be interesting, right? Like, I don't think you should be an LP investor if you don't like thinking about investments and learning, because they're just complicated. Like they're complicated and you will have questions on the best deck in the world. And it'll take some turns to get back to the GP and come back. And it takes patience and it takes time, which is why I also sort of guide people to investing certain amounts, because I think the amount I gave in as an example is like, if you invest $5,000, like the amount of time that you took to sort of like properly vet an investment already negated the return that you might not even get. And if you invest without due diligence, then you might as well, you know, put it into Bitcoin or something that has, you know, the possibility of, but not investment advice, but, you know, that has a possibility of like 10xing or 100x. Whereas a real estate investment generally doesn't follow such, you know, return thresholds. So, yeah, hopefully that helps.
That's great. You know, do you have any tips of like, you know, questions to ask a GP before investing with them, or, you know, tips on kind of what a good GP looks like?
I think there's two things here. First of all, for those people listening, 26 questions to ask your GP would be sort of like the most direct answer to that question. What I tried to do, there's two things. One is explain to people how to ask a question, which, I mean, that sounds like so elementary school, but I think it's extremely important, because how you ask a question will determine whether you get an answer that's helpful or not. And there's many different ways to sort of go around answering a question if you don't ask it properly. And then the second thing is that obviously I list a ton of questions to sort of go through, and not necessarily ask your GP, but sometimes it, as I write in that article, it's, you really should be asking these questions to yourself. And if those questions are not clear based on what you're being presented, then you should ask the GP. You should also recognize the fact that you can't ask 26 questions to a GP. Like, you know, it's right. Yeah, like you need to understand and be sensitive to the fact that they have other investors, and like you can't ask everything, and you need to prioritize. Many times in any given transaction, you'll sort of get to in your head, let's say, two or three catalysts that are like, if I can't get past these questions, like, I don't think I can, I, like, I'm not, I don't think I'm in, even if the other questions are answered well, right? So you sort of like need to do the work, and the intellectual curiosity needs to be there to sort of have that stamina to get through something and say, okay, like, I have 15 questions. I can't send 15 questions to the GP, or at least I don't think it's respectful to do so. So like, which five, let's say, or three can I send? And depending on how those go, either I'll include more because like I'm more interested in a deal and I think I can tell them that, or I'm just going to be like, I'm out. Right. But then the GP didn't need to answer 15 questions for you to be out. Right. So, you know, there's a balance, but, you know, hopefully that helps.
That's super helpful. No, I think that if more LPs would take that extra step, you know, they would not disqualify themselves, you know, from, you know, being responded to last, right? If you send a GP, you know, 50 questions, like you said, you know, they might put your email on the back burner and answer the person that answered, you know, that sent maybe one or two questions. Any tips for on PPMs, you know, when reviewing those? I mean, a lot of times it's 150 pages, you know, to hire an attorney to comb through one of these things is probably cost prohibitive. You know, what do you recommend on PPMs and what to look for?
I mean, first of all, I'm not an attorney. I rarely look at them unless they specifically relate to sort of like a business term that I'm looking into. Like, for instance, if like a deck isn't clear about a waterfall, I'll look at a PPM to sort of figure it out. I mean, like at least once, so to speak, I think you should read that thing, right? Mm-hmm. My real opinion is you should read them always. Right. And a lot of this depends on whether you're sort of investing an amount that you don't really care about. Right. And there's some level of trust, but there's sort of like a dual reality here. On the one hand, it's very rare for these things to be amended unless you're like a very big investor. So even if you find five things that are wrong with the PPM, you're not going to change them probably again, unless there's a side letter agreement. But then there's a question of whether that's fair because all the LPs didn't get it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's a whole other debate. Now, I do think from an investment perspective, it's just important, just like it was important to understand the business terms, it's important to understand the legal terms, right? And one thing that I can tell you to look out for, and I actually, like, this is something I'm very public about, is something called return of capital. Like, just making sure that the return of capital provision is very clearly stated and is part of the waterfall, and it is before the GP is in the money in terms of their promote. There are very few circumstances that they do exist, but there are very few circumstances when I think LPs should budge on that. And the reason why I say that is most decks just don't address it many times because it's so standard. So, but the dangerous part about that is then you get a deck that doesn't address it, but it's not because they think it's obvious because it's not included, right? And then you sort of get caught signing a PPM that doesn't have it. And, you know, I guess let's just say I've seen a few circumstances like that that haven't turned out to be so favorable.
Totally. Yeah. That aligned interest is super important from the LPGP side of things. So awesome, Alexei. Well, thank you so much. I know we kind of ran a little long here. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you or find your content, what's the best way for them to do so?
Yeah. So, I mean, my name is pretty unique. I'm pretty publicly available on Twitter, LinkedIn, try to post every day. And then I write weekly as well to like the 3,500 LPs that you mentioned. And that is lplessons.substack.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all these golden nuggets. And thanks for coming on the show.
For sure. Thank you so much, Andrew.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder, please leave a review if you got value out of this show. It helps us get more listeners and means the world to me. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Would you like to see Mobile Home Park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent Mobile Home Park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.